You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 456. Before you say cut, wait 5 more seconds. Wim Wenders.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Well, guys, today on the show, we have Oscar-winning director Kevin MacDonald. He first bursted onto the scene with his Oscar-winning film, Touching the Void. He later directed the film, The Last King of Scotland, which won Forest Whitaker an Oscar for Best Actor. And his latest film, The Manutarian, I think it's pronounced. It is a very interesting kind of, doesn't roll off the tongue, but it is a new film starring Jodie Foster. And Kevin and I talk about his career, his filmmaking process, how his roots in documentary filmmaking has really helped him in the narrative side, and how he's able to jump back and forth between projects like his current one with Jodie Foster and the documentary series Life in a Day, which he co-produced with Ridley Scott. I mean, we're going to talk about all sorts of different things in this interview. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Kevin MacDonald. I'd like to welcome to the show Kevin MacDonald. How you doing, Kevin?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good. Thank you so much for doing the show. I have been watching your films for quite some time since the early days. So I'm very excited to get into the weeds with you on your filmmaking process and your adventures in this crazy business of ours.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here. I've heard a lot about the show, so it's exciting to join you.
So how did you get into the business?
Well, I got into the business in a really weird way, I guess. My grandfather was a filmmaker, very well known in the United Kingdom. His name was Emmerich Pressburger, which you can imagine is not a very British name. He was an East European Jew from Hungary, more or less, and he made films in Germany, and then he ended up in Britain on his way to Hollywood, he thought, and met a man called Michael Powell, and together they formed a partnership, and he stayed in Britain, and that partnership went on to produce 20-something films together, which were unique because, a bit like the Coen brothers, they were, all their films were written, produced, and directed by Michael Powell, Emmerich Pressburger, the two of them, they shared all the credit. Mm-hmm. And they did some classics like The Red Shoes, Black Narcissus, A Matter of Life and Death. I mean, great classic movies of the 1940s, effectively. Now, I then grew up on a farm in Scotland, so I had nothing to do with him, nothing to do with movies. When he died, I thought, I'm going to write a book about his life, because it's just a fascinating life, escaping that Germany and arriving not speaking any English in the UK. And then, you know, within 4 years, he'd won an Oscar for screenwriting in English. And, you know, he's a kind of amazing man. And I started writing his biography and got really interested in movies and watching old movies for researching that book that I wrote about him. And that was what got me interested in it. And then I also made a documentary about him at the same time. Mm-hmm. And that got me interested in documentaries. So for many years, I was the documentary maker. I was really, not interested in drama, except, loving watching old movies. And then I made a film in 1999. I made a film called One Day in September, which won the Academy Award for Documentary. And it was about the Munich Olympic Games massacre.
Right.
1972. And it was a kind of a revolutionary film in a way at the time, because it was like, concept was, let's make a documentary thriller. Let's see if we can make an out-and-out thriller that's for a using documentary material only. And so the film was well received, and that allowed me to go on and make another one. And I made a film called Touching the Void, which is about mountain climbers. It's a documentary, but it uses reconstruction. It uses actors to reconstruct a story of a very dramatic story about two climbers who go up a mountain in the Andes, and one of them ends up breaking their leg, and the other one tries to rescue him, but in the end has to cut the rope on his friend and sort of see his friend go to his death, or he thinks to his death, and it turns out he's not. And anyway, but it's like, I did something which I thought I'd never do, which is try and combine documentary and drama, and it worked. And it was a big box office hit for a documentary. Mm-hmm. And that enabled, suddenly people were saying, oh, do you want to make a feature film? I'd never thought about making a dramatic feature film. I'd really had thought of myself as a documentary maker. And I thought, well, why the hell not? I probably never get another chance to do this. So sure. They said you have a subject, and I'd read this book, The Last King of Scotland, which was about Idi Amin in Uganda, and is a doctor from Scotland who goes and works for him, and it's kind of a political thriller, I suppose you would say, with lots of great African music. And so I went and did that, and I didn't know anything about making a film. So really the first time I'd ever been on a drama film set pretty much was when I turned up for day one.
That is fascinating. So, all right. So, and we'll get into Last King of Scotland, which I just absolutely adore. But you are one of those few directors that, that are prolific in many ways in both documentary and narrative. And you kind of danced the line, because it's not like you gave up documentary once you started doing after you did Last King of Scotland. You kept going back and forth, and you continue to go back and forth. Yeah. How do you dance that line? Because there's not many, to my knowledge, directors who are able to do both very well and consistently.
I think a lot of people see documentaries where they start out and then they get into narrative, into drama, right, making, and they think, that's grown up filmmaking, documentaries, kind of junior league. But certainly that's the way it used to be seen, I think. But I think because I started off as a real documentary nut, I was really obsessed with documentaries. I even edited a book about documentary, the history of documentary filmmaking, and buy all good retailers.
Huge box office.
I get a check for about $100 every year from it, actually.
So nice.
Good earning. Anyway, so I think that I just really genuinely love documentaries, and I love, as much as the sort of just watching them and figuring out different ways to sort of handle real life stories and real footage, as well as that, I also just love the fact that when you do a documentary, it's you and a couple of other people.
Right.
And it's very low pressure, and you can make mistakes, and you can spend a few days doing something and realize this is actually not going to work. When you're making a feature film, the pressure is so much. There's so much money riding on it. Right. And, it's exhausting. As a director, that's one of the things I think, that people who haven't made a feature film never realize. It's really exhausting.
Physically
and mentally, completely draining. And so, after you spent 2 years or wherever it takes to make a feature film, to go straight into another one, I think it's kind of, for me, psychologically hard. So I actually like to do a documentary after I've done a piece of narrative filmmaking. And I've kind of done that pretty much deliberately. But also, you know, there's times when you can't get the money for a feature film.
How do you approach structuring a documentary? Because I've dabbled in documentary, but I've never actually sat and done an entire feature. Do you construct it more in the edit on paper? Do you discover it as you go along? Do you have an outline? Do you start? I mean, I'm assuming you start with a narrative that you're kind of looking for, or is it completely exploratory the entire way?
It varies, but I like doing ones which are completely exploratory, where you kind of, I think the thing is you have an instinct. You think, there's something interesting there. There's a story that doesn't quite add up, or there's a, you know, there's a character or whatever it is. You think, there's something, I could think there could be a documentary there. Now, sometimes there isn't. And you set off, you actually make something kind of boring because you can't really find what you thought was interesting. But most of the time, your instinct is right. And so how I like to do it is just to start. A lot of my documentaries, not all, but a lot of them are kind of interview based. So I just start interviewing people and learning as I go and chatting to people for hours. Sometimes I'll interview someone for 4 or 5 hours or something. And through that process, you come across fascinating things, fascinating language and behavior and psychology. And you just get to meet people. And if you're a nosy, curious person like I am, it's kind of like there's no better thing. You have the, you know, you have the perfect excuse to ask any question you like of people. So, I generally have a sense of what the narrative is. I think if I've got a talent, it's probably, you know, being able to see a story, whether it be in a drama or in a documentary. And I pretty quickly could see, okay, that's the shape of the story. I can feel the shape of the story. Sometimes it changes a lot in the edit, but usually you have something to start with. And then you've got all this material, whether it's verite material or whether it's interviews and archive or whatever. And then you just have to start somewhere and start with a scene. So you start cutting a scene and then you cut another scene and they don't necessarily add. And then at a certain point, like, well, I've cut a lot of scenes, let's put them together and see what happens. But I think this is the thing. I think one of the reasons a lot of people don't like documentaries is I think psychologically it requires you to be really open-minded and to be open to, you know, to not be prejudiced in your thinking. So you have to sort of think, well, maybe my original ideas were wrong. Maybe actually that person isn't the hero of this story. Maybe that person turns out to be. So if you kind of, you have to balance the sense of, and you know, I feel there's a story, but also, oh, you know, maybe it's somewhere else. Maybe it's, so that kind of open-mindedness. I think a lot of directors are directors because they want to control every little thing. And if you're kind of directing to control a little thing, then documentaries aren't. The whole pleasure of documentaries is not being in control, is spontaneity. You know, things happening unexpectedly in front of the camera.
Isn't it Hitchcock that said that when you're a director, you're the god you're the god, but when you're a documentarian, the life is, or nature, or life, God is in control, or something along those lines.
You know what? I didn't know Hitchcock had said that, but I have my own version of that.
Yeah.
But I think that I always say that when I'm making a drama, I'm trying to take something that is, you know, written and set down and dead in a way, and trying to make it feel like a documentary, trying to make it feel spontaneous, to bring life into something that is sort of dead on the page. And when I'm doing a documentary, I'm trying to make what is chaos feel like it was preordained and it was scripted and written.
Because it sounds very chaotic. I mean, you're saying, we'll do a scene here, we'll do a scene there, and after I've done like 10, 15 scenes, we'll just put it together and see what happens. That, as a filmmaker, it takes a special kind of filmmaker to do that, because if you've been trained as a narrative filmmaker, that's insanity.
Yeah, no, it's totally true. It is. And I think partly the reason that, you know, I enjoy it is because I'm a chaotic person. And I believe that, you know, there's a lot of wisdom and beauty in the everyday and in things that we, you know, don't necessarily pay much attention to in narrative filmmaking. And so, I think I'm sort of turned on by the idea of things happening for real in front of my camera, a real argument, a real, a real murder, a real whatever. That there's something about that that's just super exciting. So I think, I mean, to go back to sort of Hitchcock, I feel like there are two types of directors, broadly speaking. I think there are those who are like the children of Hitchcock, who do want to control everything and imprint themselves and everything. And then there are the children of Vittorio De Sica, you know, Bicycle Thieves and all of that. And those people, of which I'm one, want to try and capture a sense of reality and a sense of the spontaneity of life. And they often use non-professional actors and use improvisation and that kind of thing. So I think they're two very different schools of filmmaking. And you are either putting reality first or you're putting your vision first.
And sometimes, and I'm trying to think of a director, I mean, Cassavetes is a good example of that.
Yeah,
he's a really good example of that. And sometimes you dance between the two. Sometimes you have a vision, but yet you're open enough to seeing what happens. Like I've personally directed a couple films that were very improv based, and you're on the edge. Like you're absolutely on the edge because you have no control. You're really just there to capture the magic. It's pretty insane.
Yeah, fun. And I think certain, you know, it's like a performance every day when you do that. Right. So it's mm-hmm. like some days when you're not feeling it, it's kind of like, when you can't get the actors to feel it and you can't, you know, you've right. got to be the person sort of creating that atmosphere of improvisational magic. And so you got to be on. And so that can be difficult. But I think all, you know, every feature film I've done or every, you know, narrative feature I've done, I think, you know, it is always a balance. It's a balance between things that you really want to control, whether that be the design or whether that be the lighting in this scene or the cinematography in that scene or the way a line is said or whatever. There are obviously certain things that you want to really control. And then the balance is the other side of it is that spontaneous stuff. So I'm always trying to have both. And in the recent film I've done, The Mauritanian, I worked with a DOP who's a great, I guess, German, British, American DOP. He lives here in LA now, but he's from Germany originally. Called Alvin Kuchler, who worked with Lynn Ramsey, who I'm sure you and all your listeners mm-hmm. know, and Danny Boyle, who did mm-hmm. Sunshine and Steve Jobs. And he's very Germanic and he's very organized. And he wants to know, what are we doing? What is this shot saying? And actually, that was really good for me working with him because he's not chaotic. He does want to think, you know, very intentionally about everything. And actually, I think the balance between the two of us worked out really, really, really well. I sort of brought more spontaneity to him and he brought more order to me.
Now, one thing when you're doing docs, you've done two documentaries on two musical icons, Bob Marley and Whitney Houston. How do you edit down a life of an icon into a feature film? Like, I mean, I'm assuming both of those could have been multi, you know, doc series, essentially.
Well, they probably could have been, but, you know, they're very, very different lives. So yeah. Bob Marley wrote all his own music, wrote songs which were about his own life and expressed the central themes of his life. And so that film in a way was, you know, it was about taking someone who is a legend, who is a myth, and humanizing them and saying, who is this person really? Who is this person who we all know, who's part of everybody's life? I mean, you can't walk down a street anywhere in the world without hearing a Marley song coming out of a restaurant or a bar or a shop. And so it's like, okay, so here's a guy who's, you know, got this whole mythology around him. Who actually was he and what was really motivating him? And that to me is often the interest I have in celebrities. It's kind of like, let's push aside the veil. Let's actually see, who is this person? And I think that's the curiosity that I have for about celebrities. I did another music film, which was a big disaster, which was about Mick Jagger. And that was done at his invitation. I sort of followed him around with a little camera in 2001. Mm-hmm. I actually watched the Twin Towers come down with Mick Jagger standing in a sort of dressing gown. That's one of my big favorite memories.
Favorite and worst at the same time.
Favorite and worst, yeah. Well, surreal is the correct
word. That's, yeah, exactly.
Surreal memory.
Right? Can you imagine?
So that film didn't work because, partly because he is a really difficult person to get a handle on and to get beneath the surface. On the surface, he's very entertaining and witty and funny, but you always feel like you're on the surface. He's very protected after, you know, 50 years of being a celebrity. Whatever.
Right.
But I also, the thing I learned was, don't ever accept a job where you don't have final cut. And I didn't have Final Cut, and the movie kind of got taken away from me and recut, and I was like, I'm never doing that again. And that's been a real important decision I made in terms of documentaries and documentaries about celebrities is, you know, you, there's no point even entering into a conversation with someone unless they're willing to give you Final Cut, because, you know, you're going to end up having to make puff piece, which you don't want to do.
Right, exactly.
And, yeah, but obviously Whitney Houston is a very different thing. You know, Whitney Houston, it was a mystery. It's like, who is this person? She's this voice which makes you cry, which is incredibly emotive, but she never wrote her own song. She never gave any interesting interviews her whole life, really. You know, she was an enigma. And that was kind of what the film was. The film that became about, you know, what's behind the enigma? Who is this? Who really is this person? Why this voice? Why is it so emotionally affecting? Is there something in her life that has given her this kind of ability to reach out and squeeze your heart? And so that actually was really hard. That was probably the hardest film I've ever made. A, because it was so dark. Her life and the family are so dark. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, you know, depressing going to work every day, to an extent. But also because it was everybody around her kind of lies about the truth. You know, like really, nobody wants to tell you what really happened. She was really like, because what was really happening was so dark. It's a difficult right. Trying to even, you know, now 10 years after her death, whatever, people still, you know, they want it to be a fairy story when it wasn't a fairy story. So yeah, that was a very difficult and different kind of film to make.
Now, so you were saying earlier, when you did The Last King of Scotland, was the first time you were actually really on a proper narrative set. That's a heck of a first set. I mean, that's not a simple film to make. This is not two people in a cafe talking. It's a fairly complex, large scale. I mean, it is really a story about the two main, you know, Forest Whitaker and James McAvoy but there are other subplots and so on. But it's a big story.
It's a big scale film. But I think, you know, sometimes ignorance is bliss. You know, you don't know.
I've heard that so many times on this show. So many times on this show, I've heard that from guests.
If you don't know, you're stepping into, you know, something difficult. I think also, you know, if you look at people's first films, a lot of people's first narrative films, they're, you know, they're some of the most interesting, because I think you're breaking the rules and you don't know you're breaking the rules. Right. They're not self-conscious. And so I was bringing my documentary techniques and my love for certain kind of films and my love for certain kind of music to this thing. And I didn't know, I wasn't trying, you know, I had actually a very interesting experience before. My brother used to produce Danny Boyle's movies. Mm-hmm. And so when I got the gig to do The Last King of Scotland, when it looked like it was actually happening, I phoned up Danny Boyle and I said, will you teach me how to make a movie?
First of all, not a bad phone call. If you have that number, not a bad number to have. So
we met for a cup of coffee, and in an hour, he gave me a 2 years of film school.
I have to stop you there. Can you give me one or two of those little tips in that 1 hour?
Sure. No, I mean, you know, there were things that were just like small technical things, like make sure your close-ups, the eye line is as close to camera as possible. And I didn't really understand why that was important. But then when I started doing it and started sort of, you know, get your eye lines as close as possible, I thought, oh, okay, I can see this. A bit like when I make a documentary, I often use the Errol Morris technique of having people looking directly into the camera using a eye direct, they're called, these reflecting things. So you can have somebody seeing your face, but it's sitting in front of the camera. And there's something about the connection between the eye and the camera that even if you can't get them directly looking into the camera, if they're just off it, because the emotion, you know, the seat of emotion is in the eyes, and that's where you want the actors to be. So, then he said things, you know, we talked about sex scenes, because I had quite a big sex scene in that with Kerry Washington and James McAvoy. And I was nervous as hell about that. And he told me, look, you got to rehearse it until it's so boring that it feels like you're doing the laundry. And, so I did that. And,
nice.
And then he said to me, if your crew like you, you're making a mistake.
Wow, that's the first time I've heard that.
Don't worry about the crew. Yeah, you know, if they like you, it's because you're letting them go early. And you shouldn't be letting them go early. You should be pushing to the edge. Anyway, there were a few others.
That's amazing. That's, oh, got to be a fly in that wall. That's, but like I said, it's a good phone call to have. But if you make that phone call, good meeting to take. So you're shooting Last King of Scotland. I mean, when you see Forrest doing what Forrest does in that film, it's remarkable. I mean, I remember that year when that movie came out. I mean, nobody could, and everybody just could not stop talking about Forrest Whitaker. And we've all, I mean, Forrest Whitaker had been Forrest Whitaker for a long time, but that moment, it was like perfect actor, perfect part, perfect director, perfect story, all hit at the exact same time. When you saw Forrest working on set, did you have an inclination of like, this is something, this is special, man. This is something going on here. Or did you just go, good take, Forrest, let's move on?
Well, you know, it was kind of complicated because I cast James McAvoy very quickly, but he wasn't a star. I needed somebody, you know, it wasn't an expensive movie. It was made for $5 or $6 million. Mm-hmm. No, £5 or £6 million. So mm-hmm. whatever that, $7 or $8 million at the time. That's 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. I met with a load. I came to LA and I sat in a room at the Sunset, the Chateau Marmont actually on Sunset. And lots of actors came in. Now, obviously, I'd never done auditions before, really. So I didn't know, what you were meant to do. But all the, I had an experienced casting director and actors came in and I met kind of every well-known African-American actor of the time. And person after person came in and I thought, they're not right. It doesn't feel right. And Forrest Whitaker had been put on the list. And I had said to the casting director, Forrest Whitaker is so clearly not right because he's such a gentle guy. His whole thing was this very lovely, zen, kind of gentle giant persona. And the casting director said to me, well, you know, we can't say no now to him because it will, you know, be offensive. Let's just get, let him come in. And Forrest arrived. And so literally I had less than zero expectations. I thought we were just taking the meeting because we had to. And he came in and he prepared like two scenes, which very few actors do for an audition. You know, they're not, you know, main actors. They're not, he had prepared and he did an approximation of a Ugandan accent, which he'd also had to prepare. So it was immediately clear that here's someone who really wanted this, who really connected with it in some way.
So he actually essentially auditioned. I mean, he's a name actor.
He auditioned.
Wow.
And he prepared these scenes and we did them. And he was amazing. And he so different than what I'd seen in Forrest Whitaker before. And I guess it was a lesson to me, you know, if somebody really wants to do something, even if you think there's no way they're going to be right, let them show themselves, you know, because sometimes people have got other things inside. I remember saying to Forrest, you know, I thought you were too nice. And he said, I've got a lot of anger inside me. and so, you know, I think, yeah, like a lot of really nice people, you know, maybe they're hiding something else, you know, maybe it's this way they've been brought up or whatever, is to sort of, you know, appear to be quite passive. So, and he came to Uganda where we were shooting it, which was, I think, a key decision for me. I decided we have to shoot this in Uganda. The financiers wanted to shoot it in South Africa, which was the kind of the known film place in Africa. And I went to both South Africa and Uganda and South Africa has made people look completely different. The landscape is completely different. The dress is completely different. You know, architecture is different. And I said, we've got to be in Uganda. And I think that's a consistent thing throughout my career. I mean, it's either a good thing or a bad thing that I have no imagination about how to turn one place into another place. If somewhere feels like really real, I'm like, well, we should shoot it here. Why would we not shoot it here? This is about the quality, you know, that we're not going to get if we try and build a set or we do it, you know.
Right, right.
So I think that texture of the reality, the real feeling of a place is important in filmmaking. And so he came to Uganda a month before we started shooting. And he hung out, he learned the language, he started eating Ugandan food. He just really immersed himself in it in a way that, you know, was deeply impressive, but also sometimes slightly worrying, because he started to believe that he was Idi Amin in a way. And he started to believe that Idi Amin was an innocent man, and that all these rumors he had killed people, oh, it's just rumors, you know, it's not reality. Because as he said to me later, when he sort of came out of the side, I have to believe that this man is a good person, a sympathetic person. So, he went in deep. So it became a kind of very interesting thing on set, actually, because often I was having to push him to be more villainous, you know, more aggressive, more mean, more whatever, because his instinct was always to kind of go, oh, I mean, and I'm a good guy.
Right.
And a very interesting dynamic. So you say, was I looking at his performance and going, oh my God, there's something incredible and special here? I was, but I was feeling like, you know, this is a battle of wills in a way. But for him to get him to show the side of Idi Amin that he didn't want to show. Anyway. So that was a very interesting. And also, though, on top of that, there's a very interesting kind of racial dynamic, obviously. So Forrest was a African-American guy who was going to Africa for the first time. And I think that can be, for any African-American, I think can be a really profound and meaningful, moving experience. Mm-hmm. And so I think he was sort of dealing with all of that. And in some ways, I became a kind of surrogate for the colonial idea, you know, the colonialist in Africa or something. And so there was quite a lot of friction in the, it, you know, and it all ends up in the film in a good way, because the film is about colonialism, about post-colonialism, and about, I guess, what we would now call white privilege. You know, right. The idea you go as a white person into Africa and you're like, nobody can touch me. I can do what I want. I'm special. Mm-hmm. I got money. I can just get on a plane and leave if anything goes wrong. That's kind of what the film is about. And so the energy that Forrest brought and his attitude to me and whatever actually really played into the film.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
So like you were saying, that a lot of times, you know, in actors, especially in these kind of roles, the director, sometimes you just let them go and you kind of maneuver. But I feel that from what you're saying, it was your presence and his presence together that really built that up, because you're saying that without that friction, he might have just been a really nice, nice murderer.
Exactly. And obviously there was the side of because the movie is kind of like, you know, the character rather is a guy who, and what makes it such a good performance is a guy who is funny and likable and sweet, but also that it's a monster. And he's a sort of child in some way psychologically whose development has been stunted by his experience of colonialism and the expectations placed on him by colonialism. And so he knows no other way to control things than through sort of temper tantrums and violence and, you know, aggression. So the end, it was a fascinating experience. And of course, because it was my first feature film, I didn't know this was unusual or normal or what it was. You know, this was just like, oh, this is an interesting experience. And there were all sorts of things on that film which, you know, you would never normally do. So we had soldiers from the Ugandan army come, and they had their real rifles with them. And a lot of them were fighting the war in the north of Uganda at that time. And they were war vets, and some of them had PTSD, and an explosion or something, or gunfire in the film would go off, and they would all go kind of crazy. And so it was a very febrile atmosphere at times on the set. But it was also, it had a degree of kind of non-professionalism, which I think was useful, you know. So we had a lot of the crew, we couldn't afford to take all our crew. So we trained a lot of people in Uganda who had done little bits of maybe a local video or this or that, or, you know, but they didn't, you know, like the electricians were just household electricians. The hair and makeup were just people we found who did hair and makeup in Kampala, the capital. And so we, you know, it had this homemade feel to it, which I think was really nice. And it also meant that I was always exposed to real Ugandan opinions about Idi Amin and about the story I was telling. And people would not be shy about saying to me, no, it wouldn't happen like that. Or no, you know, that line isn't right. I remember one in particular, there was like, the guy said to me, there was a scene where Amin is with two hookers and they were originally called, you know, Susan and Jane or something. And this guy came up to me, he was like working on the film, one of the electricians, he said, in those days, all the hookers in Uganda were called Betty. That's what they should be called. That was the name they all used. And
wow.
And but more than that, there were people coming up to me in the film, people, crew members, Ugandan crew members, who would say, you know, this is an important story to tell because, you know, Amin killed my father, or you know, this is the consequences of the, you know, this is the consequences of this for my family were X, Y, and Z. So it became this very meaningful experience for the whole crew. They were all doing something that actually affected everyone in the country.
That's a remarkable story. You're directing, the first time you're really directing actors in that. You've gone on to direct, you know, bigger films, larger scope films. I mean, the state of play alone has an insane ensemble cast. Remarkable cast. I mean, as I was watching, I'm like, he's in this too, and she's in this too, and she's like, my God, like, how did he get all these? This is amazing. What is your approach to directing actors? Because I know every director has their own kind of flavor of doing it. How do you approach directing actors?
Well, I think it's probably the thing that I was most nervous about, when I came from documentary, that not really understanding and feeling that actors were kind of an alien species. What is it they actually do? How do they, you know? And that's, it's taken me quite a few films, I think, to get into the position where I'm comfortable. I feel comfortable in the presence of actors and comfortable understanding, I guess, what they're trying to do and how best to communicate with them. I think it is a complicated thing. I think people who maybe come from a background in having done a lot of short films or having done a lot of theater or whatever, maybe a better place, you know, than I was when I started. But I think that, you know, what I try and do very simply is to create an environment for the actor where they feel like they can try anything out. And I'm really kind of unjudgmental most of the time, because I'll try and get people to feel not just comfortable on the set, and it's a kind of family atmosphere in the set, and a loose sort of feel, and a place where they can make mistakes and nobody's going to judge them. You know, I want my actors to make mistakes. I want them to sort of try something and like, oh, actually that didn't work. Let's do something. And I guess I'm always just trying to get, it's what I said earlier, I think, about spontaneity. I'm trying to get it to feel like it's real. Try and feel like the emotion in that moment is real. And I think through improvisation, whether it might be like, you know, just throwing things up in the air, saying, you know, forget about the dialogue, just do in this scene what you think you should say. And you try that once, and maybe you might get a moment that's really great, but it also might just loosen them up. And also, I think one of the things you learn is that, you know, I remember being terrified in my first couple of films when you rehearse a scene with actors, and the scene doesn't work. And you're like, oh my God, why did this just doesn't work, does it? Mm-hmm. And then you're left thinking, oh my God, what do I do about it? And do I rewrite the dialogue? Right. Am I just cut this? Do I whatever? And I think that what you realize is that you listen to the actors, because it's usually not working because the dialogue is or the action that's described in the script is not what their character would do. And they know their character way better than anyone else. And they are usually the one that can help. And they can say to you, so many times your scenes are saved by an actor saying to me, you know, I just wouldn't say that. But if he said that and I said this, then suddenly like that makes sense for my character. And you're like, oh yeah, that's of course, totally right. Yeah. And, so yeah, I mean, I admire what actors do so much, and I could never ever do it myself. And I think there's nothing better than that moment of magic when the camera turns over for the first time and the actor does something to a scene that you thought you knew what it was about, and suddenly it's like, whoa, this is about so much more than I thought. I was seeing the surface of this, and there's so much else going on here, and the actor has just made that happen on camera. And I love that.
But now, I also think, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that, you know, I'm always fascinated. When I started out, I used to think I want to do lots and lots of rehearsal.
Right.
And I used to try and get as much rehearsal as possible time with the actors. And I've slowly come to realize that actually rehearsing usually with screen actors is only useful up to a point. There's no point in doing more than 2 or 3 days of it because people do not bring their A game to the rehearsal. They maybe don't even bring their C game to the rehearsal because they're holding it all. So what rehearsals are great for is going through the scenes and trying to iron out those script problems that are going to cost you a huge amount of time when you get on set. You don't want to be sitting there discussing my motivation in this scene 2 hours in the morning when you've got a hell of a lot to do. So to discuss your motivation in that scene or to iron out dialogue that doesn't work or just to generally talk about the scenes, it's great. But actually performance, I found that never ever do you get something in rehearsal that really even closely resembles what you'll end up with on set. So I will try and do 2 or 3 days of rehearsal because I do think it saves time ultimately later on, but I don't think there's much value in doing more than that.
Now, your latest film, and please forgive me, the Mauritanian?
Mauritanian, you got it right.
There it is. I got it. The Mauritanian, starring the legendary Jodie Foster. Can you talk a little bit about that film?
Yeah, so this is a film which I've been trying to make for like 3 years. It's a very difficult subject matter, I guess. It's about a prisoner in Guantanamo Bay prison. And we sort of take his point of view through the film. And he's played by a wonderful French actor called Tahar Rahim, who people might have seen him in A Prophet, the Jacques Audiard film from like 2009, I think it was. Which, if you haven't seen it, it's a great, great prison sort of gangster movie. He is an old friend of mine. We worked together a few, 10 years ago. And he, is a French actor, but Arabic origin and, North African origin. And, but has recently learned to speak English wonderfully. So he performs in French and Arabic and English. And, I needed to cast in order to get even a small amount of money to make this movie. He wasn't obviously a star enough, and I needed to cast some big names. And I was lucky enough that one of the producers on the project was Benedict Cumberbatch. He of Sherlock fame.
Yes.
And Dr. Strange.
Dr. Strange fame. Yes. Yes.
And, so he's a producer on the project, and he came on board as an actor to play a supporting role. And then I that still wasn't enough. And then Shailene Woodley came on board, doing again, a supporting role. And then I needed, the other kind of main role aside from Tahar Rahim, who plays the prisoner in Guantanamo, is the defense lawyer, a real person called Nancy Hollander. And the first person in my head was Jodie Foster, because I could see that this character has got to be someone who's really tough on the outside, and kind of, a little brittle, but doesn't want to let you in. But when you do see inside, you see someone who's kind of a bit broken, a bit uncomfortable in their own skin. And I thought that if you look back at Jodie's best performances, there were always something in that area.
Yeah.
And I sent the script to her pretty much 100% certain she's going to say no, because Jodie doesn't really act anymore. She's so fussy about what she does. She wants to direct. She kind of, as even her agent said to me, I'll send it to her, but I don't
good luck.
Yeah, exactly. 3 days later, she comes back to me and she says, let's meet and talk. And funnily enough, because we're discussing the title, The Mauritanian.
Mm-hmm. Just rolls off the tongue. Just rolls off the tongue.
That was the reason she responded to the email, because she saw, what the hell is the Mauritanian? She said. I never changed it.
So that's so note to everybody, make your title a completely very difficult word to say that no one recognizes, and that's going to get it.
That was kind of an interesting thing because we did have a lot of arguments about the title. In fact, the film was sold under a different title, but it came back eventually to the Mauritanian, thanks in part to Jody saying, you know, that's the title that hooked me. And also, there was a word of wisdom I got from my brother, who's a producer and who produced the Alex Garland's film Ex Machina. Mm-hmm. But there's another title. Nobody knows how to say that.
Rolls off the tongue.
But they had come to the conclusion when they were making that. I think the producer, Scott Rudin, had said to them, it's fine to have a title that nobody knows what it is because that's intriguing. What is that? What does that mean? How do you say it? Mm-hmm. I kind of think this, you know, rather than kind of justice and honor, or something generic.
Right. You know what? To be fair, if it would have been called Justice and Honor, I would have been like, eh. But this, no, you're absolutely right. There is something to be said. I had a friend of mine who had a film called Upsolidia. And it was a made up word. And she told me, she was a Scottish director. And she told me, she's like, it's the best thing because anyone looks us up on Google, we're the only thing. We're number one. We're number one on Google for Upsolidia.
Yeah. Anyway, so Jody and I talked about the character. We did some work. She was very astute about who this character was and how much she needed. I mean, it was the first actor I ever worked with where she would go through the script and go, "I don't need that. Don't need that. Cut it out. Cut it." Cut. Because she's so precise about, you know, what she needs to express who this character is, and her whole feeling was, this is not about me. This is about Mohamedou, who's the prisoner in Guantanamo, and I don't want to have like it to be about my personal life, my failed marriage. Those things can sit, you know, in a very nuanced way in the background, maybe, but this is about me being a lawyer and doing my job and trying to create a relationship with this prisoner. And she worked on the script with me for a few weeks, and then said, yeah, I'm in. And that was great because I think, you know, she is still, as you said, a legend, and she still brings a lot of cachet, you know, to the project. And that was the final piece in the jigsaw puzzle to get the movie financed and get it made. And it's an amazing ensemble cast, if you think about it, you know, mm-hmm. Shailene and Benedict and Jodie, and Tahar is just magnificent. You know, I mean, I think, mm-hmm. you know, he was nominated for Globe the other day for Best Actor. Jodie won for Best Supporting Actor at the Globes. And, you know, I think they deserve it. And I think they deserve, you know, more. So, you know, I think it's something magical. So when you get two actors together who work in very different styles, like Jodie and Tahar, mm-hmm. Tahar is a very kind of improvisational, try this, try that kind of thing. And Jodie's very much like she's thought about it. She knows. But seeing them playing off against each other, that each one kind of seeps into the style of the other, it's really rewarding.
So if our interview has said or our conversation has said anything, obviously you shot in Guantanamo Bay. So when you flew in, it was why everyone just let you in, right? It was no problem at all. You just got a permit. You just call up. You just call for a permit.
It's what, you know, they'd all seen Sherlock and they all wanted to. Wanted Benedict or Doctor Strange, probably would see. No, of course we couldn't shoot that there. We shot that in South Africa. We shot the whole movie except between South Africa and Mauritania, which is a country for those who don't know. So I also, by the way, on the subject of the title, my last word on the title, I said to people, you know, the Mandalorian. Nobody told them that doesn't mean anything. How do you say it?
To be fair,
we'll get a few people watching our movie who have accidentally come into the theater thinking they were buying a ticket to the theatrical Mandalorian. That would be
and they'd be going, "Where's the baby Yoda? Where's the baby Yoda? I see Jodie Foster. I don't see a baby Yoda." If you would add a baby Yoda at the final cut somewhere, I think the box office might go up a bit.
They might have gone through. Yeah. So, but we shot in Mauritania, which is on the northwest coast of Africa, below Morocco, above Senegal. And it's like one of the biggest countries in Africa, but nobody knows of it because it's like 3 million people. And it's desert. It's basically a big chunk of the Sahara Desert. And the people dress in this beautiful way and flowing sort of robes, and the women are in colorful kind of head scarves. And it's really a stunning place. Dunes, camels, 500 miles of white beach that nobody goes on. It's amazing. And so we shot there for a week for the bits of it which set in Mauritania, and the rest of it is South Africa. And we constructed our Guantanamo on the coast in South Africa, because the real Guantanamo is obviously right on the coast in Cuba. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, there could be a, you know, Sandals Beach Resort or something there, if there wasn't a prison. It's a kind of tropical paradise.
Yeah, I've heard a bunch of stories about it. I'm Cuban by birth.
Oh.
So I've heard many stories of Guantanamo and the soldiers fishing and just hanging out on the beach.
They go surfing
and stuff. It's an insane place. It's like there's no other place like it on the planet, really.
Sort of the whole point, the reason that they opened the prison there is because it's America, but it's not. So American law, according to George Bush's lawyers, does not apply there because it's actually Cuba. And America only leases it. So, of course, there's many, many contradictions in that. It's kind of like, you've got a naval base there, and the people, the soldiers and sailors have to abide by American law. There's even, you know, America's endangered animals laws apply there because there's a lot of reptiles, you know, what are they called, lizards and things. Mm-hmm, where, mm-hmm. One of the ironies of Guantanamo is that all over the prison are these signs which say, do not touch the iguanas. Fine of $10,000 if you touch the iguanas. Or, of course, at the same time, they're torturing prisoners and, you know, not offering people the opportunity to even have a trial. And that's really what the film's about. It's about this, you know, the idea that these people were plucked from places in the world. They were accused of terrorism and then never charged because they didn't have evidence against a lot of them. 85% of the people who went there were just innocent people who got picked up because their neighbor, you know, did a deal with the American government and got $50,000 off them or whatever. You know, America dropped a lot of leaflets in places and said, you know, if you have an Al-Qaeda member in your midst, you know, give them to them. We'll give you $100,000. And of course, people were like, oh, I don't like Brian who lives down the road. I'm going to pretend he's an Al-Qaeda member. I'm going to sell him and I'm going to get rich. And that's what happened. So they do reckon that, as I say, 80-85% of the people there had nothing ever to do with terrorism. And he was one of them. And yet he was caught there for 14 and a half years. And it's the story of that injustice. And I think, you know, what's, I think, for me, the key to the story and the key why I wanted to make it is there are so few movies, particularly American movies, maybe none in the mainstream, which have a sympathetic Muslim lead.
Oh, man, none.
Yeah. So here's a movie which is basically the trick of the movie is we're trying to get you as someone who might be, you know, anti-Muslim, mm-hmm. anti-terrorism, anti-whatever, we're all anti-terrorism, but you know what I mean. And you, by the end of the movie, you fall in love with this guy. And you feel like this is a terrible injustice. So you start off feeling like, oh, he's, you know, like everybody at Guantanamo, he must be guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up feeling like, oh, I love him. I want to have a drink with him. And so that was the simple goal of the film.
That's amazing. And where is it available right now to see?
It is available to see right now in a very few theaters, wherever some theaters are open, and they're mostly available on PVOD. I think it's on, you know, all the usual pay-per-view platforms.
Now, I'm going to ask you a few questions I ask all my guests. If you could go back and tell your younger self one thing, what would it be?
About sex or about movie making?
About life in general. But let's keep it. I mean, sex, absolutely. We could all go back because Jesus Christ, really. No, I'm talking about the business. Let's say about the business.
Okay. What would I go back and tell myself? That's a really hard one. I think that, you know, the key to any artistic endeavor, I think, is to find out what your subjects are and what your style is, discovering who you are as an artist. And I think that takes some time and takes some mistakes. And so I think that, you know, movies are very high pressure business. and people are always terrified, and a lot of the bad behavior that happens in the movie business is because of fear. Mm-hmm. I would say don't be frightened. You know, expect to fail. Don't worry about it. You know, that's how you make discoveries. That's how you find what's good and what you really should be doing. And also, I think you just have to accept that, you know, not everything you do works. And obviously, in the old days and the studio system, you know, you'd be a filmmaker and you'd make 10 films in 5 years, and three of them would make money and the rest wouldn't. And that wasn't a problem. One of the difficulties these days is that, you know, you're just judged on the performance of your last film always. And that's a very high pressure thing. So try and ignore that pressure. That would be my advice.
Now, what advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
Be yourself. Try and find the ideas that are uniquely or originally yours, and don't worry too much about technique. I think a lot of the young filmmakers I meet and talk to are so obsessed with technique and with, you know, style. And I kind of think, well, ultimately, that if you're making a pop video, yeah, that's super important. But if you're making a movie that people want to really connect to and love, it really doesn't matter. So I think people are obsessed too much about style.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film industry or in life? This could be about sex.
I'm not going to inflict those on my list. So what's the lesson that I took the longest? Well, I think maybe, you know, this is a cop out, but I'm going to say working with actors, trying to understand and not feel that actors are aliens. You know, directors are from Mars, actors are from Venus. No, it's not true. We're actually both from planet Earth. And I think it's that sort of being talking in very simple emotional terms to actors, and understanding, you know, what the limits of what they can do and what they can bring to a scene. But I think, you know, I remember talking to great British director Stephen Frears.
Yes.
And he said to me, you know, as a director, 90% of your work is done before you even step onto the set. It's about the script and the casting. And if you've got those two things right, it's hard to mess up. And I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And finally, three of your favorite films of all time.
Oh, boy, you should give me some warning about that. Three of my favorite films. Okay. The Battle of Algiers.
Okay, yeah.
Which is a very influential film on me. Right. I would also say a film made by my grandfather, which I'm allowed to have in this list. Which
absolutely.
I would encourage everyone to watch it. It's The British Citizen Kane. It's called The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp.
Of course. I've seen the Criterion Collection Laserdisc. I saw that many years ago.
Criterion Collection, exactly. And then I'd have to say Singing in the Rain, because it's the most perfect movie ever made.
It very, very true. Very, very true. Kevin, thank you so much for being on the show. It has been an absolute pleasure talking to you, and continued success. And I really am glad that there's filmmakers like you out there still trying to push the envelope and taking those swings at bat with stories that are important. And it's not, I'm a big fan of the superhero films. I'm a big fan of the big pop films, but sometimes you'd like a nice meal as opposed to just fast food all the time. So I appreciate you, my friend. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Really nice to talk.
I want to thank Kevin for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe. Thank you very, very much, Kevin. If you want to get links to anything we talked about in this episode, please head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/456. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com and subscribe and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. Thank you again so much for listening, guys. We got some bunch of good stuff cooking coming up for you in the next few weeks. I appreciate your time. As always, keep that hustle going, keep that dream alive, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.